Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, just the facts. And now, here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio! I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, silliness, videos, other things like chances to win free stuff at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me, Jack!
Woo!
So that was the mood I would have been in had the Bengals won last night, but the Bengals didn't win last night, so now I'm in this mood. We pre-recorded that intro, assuming that no, I'm kidding. Anyway, yes, so I get it out of the way. A lot of you know I'm a Bengals fan. I'd like to say I'm no longer a Bengals fan because, honestly, how long can this go on? And I just keep taking it, but I'm coming back next year because that's what I do. That was really, really heartbreaking, though, to see people's worst natures come out at the end of a game. And my little heart was crushed, and all the Who's cried. All the Who's in Whoville.
You did not get any rare roast beefs.
No.
Not at all.
Anyway. Hey, quick reminder, this segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s, ARs, and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories at www.wilsoncombat.com. So, tonight it is the... Well, as often times rolls around every fourth episode or so, the Facebook users question show. But tonight we're giving away something that's a little bit cooler than the patches that we give away or other things that we give away. Not that those aren't cool. Actually giving away an SSVI tier Glock trigger, which is my very, very favorite aftermarket trigger available for the Glock family of firearms. It's about $150, $125 value, so it's like a legit prize. And to get in on that, all you had to do was submit questions on our Facebook page. We're going to answer them right now. Our favorite one will win something. Completely at random, not completely at random at all. If we like your question, you might win. If we don't, well, anyway, Jack.
Alrighty. Our first question, and we actually had a few people ask this, but I like how he worded it better. Calvin Smith, would modifying a trigger on a CCW work against you in a court case in a self-defense situation?
Maybe. So if it were a completely justified shooting that was relatively clear-cut and did not involve any questions of things being... accidental. Yeah, I don't see as to where it'd have any problems. You need to be able to articulate why you are modifying your pistol, and because some dude with a beard and tattoos told you to is not an articulation. You know, if you say something like, well, I wanted to be able to fire my gun more accurately under stress so that I placed, you know, bystanders' lives at less risk so I could be more precise or something like that. That's a pretty good articulation. The issue becomes if you modify your trigger and get something dangerous, whether it's something that disables drop safeties or, you know, a 1.5 pound Glock trigger or whatever, then yeah, that can be a problem. Especially if there's any level of ambiguity or if you make, a completely... I'll give you, for instance, you say something like, well, I didn't want to shoot him, or, well, of course you didn't want to shoot him. You didn't wake up today going, I didn't, you know, oh, I want to go out and get into self-defense shooting today. You know, hopefully you don't say that. No, normal people don't. But you say something completely innocuous or innocent in the heat of the moment or afterwards to the police, and then all of a sudden an overzealous prosecutor gets a hold of that, and, you know, you've dropped an aftermarket trigger in your gun, and, well, a good defense attorney is going to be able to explain that, but the thing to keep in mind is that if you get to the point where you've got a good defense attorney, then you're, you know, in a trial, and anything that you need to explain is more money. Just something to consider. But at, you know, in general, does modifying your carry gun have negative legal ramifications for you? No, assuming that it is not something that goes completely against industry norms and is something that you can articulate, if that makes sense.
I think that kind of answers it out.
Maybe.
Well, for some people.
Yeah. Alrighty. Anyway, another question.
Okay. Coming from Eric Fine. Thoughts on Glock replacement sites?
Yes. You should. You know, so the thing about the sights that are on the Glock from the factory, unless it's their steel night sights, they're essentially plastic dovetail protectors. I have seen them break for, like, no reason. Very, very easily. Honestly, too, the design itself is not one that I prefer. They've got that U at the back, that white outline U. What I find is most people, their eye is drawn to the rear sight, which is not what we want. We want the eye to be drawn naturally to the front sight, so a high visibility front, low, you know, visibility to blacked out entirely rear sight, because it sort of just channels our vision through the rear sight to the front sight, and then we go from there. For night sights, I'm a big fan of the Trigicon HD, though I will say, and I don't know when this happened or when I made the breakthrough that I'm to this point right now. I have been getting a lot out of a fiber optic front. I prefer the Dawsons because of how they're made. They also are the thinnest ones that I can find. Been running a fiber optic front, just a plain black rear, and I seem to be getting, you know, quite a bit more precision at longer range. Not that I couldn't hit things at longer ranges before, it's just more precise shots at longer range. A little bit quicker and certainly more precision up close. So that's just sort of a natural progression to what I've been doing or had preferred in the past. But yeah, you want to change something around. Just avoid rear sights that overpower the front sight. And this is across the board. You know, I personally like a little bit taller. You know, there's two schools of thought here, and I completely agree that the other school of thought is probably right. You either have sights that sit lower to the slide or sights that sit a little higher off the slide, and I prefer the ones that are a little taller. But I'm kind of weird about several things like that. Anyway, we're answering your questions tonight. We got to go to break. Right now you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by Dark Star Gear. Whether you know the color of the boathouse at Hereford or only know the color of your mom's basement. And Cheeto Saint Socks. Here, that's a good one. Well, I do that one a lot.
You do that one a lot.
I come up with something better. Soul-crushing disappointment of where you're at in your life. Ooh. Dark Star Gear has a solution to your gear-carrying needs. That was a little too serious. That got really dark here. Like Dark Star Gear. Check out their clip-on holster for semi-autos and revolvers, or their highly adjustable full-size AIWB holster. They even have a belt-wrapped sheath for popular fixed-blade centerline knives to really tie your ADC together. Like that one rug I used to have that the golfer ruined.
Golfer?
Bowler? No. Cricket. Clearly you're not a golfer. Come on.
Oh. I'm sorry.
You're fired. Designed, developed, and pressure tested for real life, not Instagram. Find out more at darkstargear.com. Actually, you're hired again because I'm...
You don't have the questions right
yeah,
now.
No, I don't. That's exactly why. So we are answering your questions tonight and giving away free stuff. Well, one free thing to a lucky, lucky... lucky boy and or girl. Or both. Who knows? Whatever you identify as, we're cool with it. No? Yes, we are.
I'm so
we're very tolerant
right
here. Anyway, please.
All right, from Nick Krulo. What are your thoughts on carry revolvers? Are they still relevant as a primary carry option, or should they be relegated to small backup guns? What caliber and gun size would you recommend?
So if I were going to carry a revolver as a primary, I have a Model 19 Smith & Wesson that I shoot really well. The problem is a revolver is a one bad guy gun, tops. And the reason why I say that is that when we look at like typical, you know, attacks and engage civilian engagements specifically, what do those look like? And I am biased towards Tom Givens' numbers because I'm, you know, I've been through his instructor class and his advanced instructor class, and I respect Tom a lot. But, you know, when we look at those numbers, I think the greatest number of shots fired was 11 out of a 40 caliber SIG 229, or maybe, anyway, right around there. And I'm sure Lee is in the chat and he's getting ready to correct me because he's much more intellectual about remembering things like that than I am. But anyway, I was going somewhere. Oh, the point that I was trying to make is that gets us through one bad guy, usually. Somewhere in the 5 to 6 round range is where I feel pretty comfortable that I'm going to be able to deal with what I find myself in if it involves one attacker that is bent on continuing the fight. You know, and that might get me through 2 or 3 or however many attackers if they decide they don't want to get shot. But if they decide they want to stay and fight, I don't feel too good about 6 rounds. The other thing to keep in mind, too, is that generally whoever runs out of bullets first loses. I mean, we've got all sorts of data to support that, not necessarily in a civilian context. So I am actually aware of one instance where someone ran out of ammo and was killed, courthouse shooting in Texas. But, you know, so if you're going to carry a revolver, I think having a reload is a good idea, too. Or two fingers, since that's what Jack just pointed at me if you were watching the video chat. But, so yeah, I think that's fine. I think people get caught up on, you know, gear and having, you know, stuff because cool guys have stuff. But honestly, if what you shoot the best is a revolver, then carry a revolver. I'd be fine with that Model 19 if that's what I had. You know, I'm a big fan of the Gold Dot 38 plus P, 135 grain. Magnum cartridges are not... The juice is not worth the squeeze. 357 Magnum does not do anything that a good 9mm 38, you know, other than if it, unless we're let me back up, unless we're talking about creature defense like out in the woods, and I can't shoot a 40. Well, I can shoot a 41 pretty fast, but that's hard ammo to find. But a 44 Magnum or something like that, you know, when you actually see advantages. I can't shoot that well enough to go to that, and it doesn't fit. It's not useful in enough circumstances. It's useful in a very narrow set of circumstances. I want to be prepared for the broadest range of scenarios possible, which is why I do 9mm, you know, high-capacity service pistol of some sort. Lee heard that he's supposed to correct me, but he missed from what he was supposed to correct me because he wasn't paying attention. So, hey, I guess I answered that question then. Lee doesn't know I was wrong, so that's all that matters. Anyway, moving on.
All right, from Amber Wren. If you had to recommend one type of training for guns or general defense of any sort, what would it be?
See, didn't she originally say, especially if you were a female, or did I make
that
up? Yeah,
it's a long question.
Okay, well, you left out an important part. Shame on you, Jack.
Shame. Ding-ling.
Yeah. I really think Craig Douglas's ECQC class is probably the best class there is for almost anybody for two specific reasons. One of them is the managing unknown contacts portion, which is day one. It's actually evening one. It's a 2.5-day class. The first half day is dedicated to managing unknown contacts. What that is how do we interact with people that may or may not be threats? You know, how do we deal with that? What are some best practices? Things like that. Of all the things that I have gone and learned how to do and worked on, managing unknown contacts is the one thing that I use almost every single day. And that's not to say that I don't like going, you know, and taking an advanced pistol handling class or working problems through in the shoot house or something like that. But thankfully, my application of those skills has been rather limited in a, you know, civilian context. But the managing unknown contacts portion is literally what we do to not have to do the other stuff. The other thing is that ECQC is geared specifically towards the 0 to 5 foot problem. So what happens if we fail the interview process when an attacker's deciding whether or not, you know, we're a go or a no-go? And what happens if we make a mistake and get ourselves in that situation? A lot of the things that seem like really good ideas, once we have perfect situational awareness and, you know, can see the attack coming and it's zero ambiguity and, oh, this guy's a shoot problem, let's shoot him. It's not what a lot of those look like. And the other thing, too, is that the likelihood that if I have a problem, it's probably because I messed up. And if I messed up, I probably let him get too close and maybe I should work on that problem. Here's why I think it's especially important for females. When you look at the assaults that they are most often subjected to, they are close range assaults. You know, they can be sex crimes a lot of times, or, you know, whatever. For whatever reason, I see a lot of these start closer than they do at other times. And not to say that they don't start close for other people too, but I think that it's an important skill to have worked, especially if you are likely to be facing a size disadvantage and a general strength disadvantage, which when you compare genders is just, you know, sort of the facts of the matter. So that's, I think it's a really important class for everybody. It seems to have extra, no, it's, you know what? It's just important for everybody. Go take that class. You know, we all have to deal with a lot of the same problems, which is we messed up, we're getting attacked. How do we fix that? And, you know, if you're a boy or a girl or whatever, once again, whatever you identify with, we're cool. Those are really important skills to have. The other stuff we can, I'm not going to say figure out as we go through it because that's a terrible plan, but the chances of success are a little bit better figuring out easier problems than they are in the worst problems. And the entangled gunfight is probably the worst problem or one of the worst problems. So anyway, we got a couple minutes. Another question.
Everyday carry light on the pistol or handheld?
Is that a binary question where we must only choose one?
I see it as por que no los dos.
If I have to pick between a handheld or a weapon-mounted light, I would rather have the handheld light, and let me tell you why. Most of the people that I see using weapon-mounted lights are not using them what I consider to be appropriately. They are also misunderstanding what I consider their primary function to be. And their primary function is not, you know, searching or assessing. I mean, if that's what you got, that's what you got, and there are ways to do it. But the primary function of a weapon-mounted light is shooting with two hands in the dark when you need a light. And honestly, once again, if we look at typical scenarios and where does true dark exist, true dark doesn't exist very many places anymore. Now, I live in the middle of nowhere. Weapon-mounted light for me is a consideration that actually, you know, I can justify a little bit easier because it gets true dark where I live. You know, and there's critter control issues that I have had in the past. There's all sorts of reasons, but the weapon-mounted light for me is not necessarily a two-legged predator sort of thing. The handheld light is useful in all sorts of situations. It can diffuse a lot of situations. If you light somebody up, you know, they know that you know they're there. They're not expecting that most of the times. It's much easier to search with those without pointing a gun at something that maybe we don't want to point a gun at. It's really hard to accidentally shoot someone with your handheld light if you get confused on the switchology or have a sympathetic grasp response or just any sort of issues that can come with that. That having been said, I mean, I carry a weapon-mounted light on my pistol. I think there's benefit to them. I don't think they are a necessary item. And honestly, I think that the insistence that people have them is not really contextually – sound for a lot of people. I mean, I could be off base on that, but we'll say this. If we're going to have a home defense gun, I really like having a light on the home defense gun because I, you know, people, whether or not they think to grab a light off the nightstand, well, if it's attached to the gun, they have it. Now, once again, they need to use it properly and all that, but anyway, we've got to go to break. When we get back, more of your questions. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by TopGunSupply.com. TopGunSupply.com is your web source for fine firearms parts and accessories. True product specialists committed to delivering the highest level of customer support to you. They carry top name brands including Ed Brown, Wilson Combat, Les Bears, Sig Sauer, and many more, as well as premium error pattern rifles. Whether you are looking to protect yourself or a first-time gun buyer or a competitive shooter, TopGunSupply.com can satisfy your firearms needs. TopGunSupply.com, your premier source for SIG parts and accessories. Make sure you check out the giveaway from them this month. We're giving away a knife, a knife. Just got to go to the Facebook page. I'm just going to beat this drum until everyone gets tired of hearing the tune and click the giveaway tab at the top of the page. So, Jack, shiny and chrome. I like how you just press that on air button during the break and start talking.
Mistakes were made. Okay, from Stephen Bell. For a defensive...
Wait. You don't want to keep talking about the mistakes that were made?
I don't.
Are you sure?
I'm maintaining.
Okay.
From Stephen
Bell. What if I want to interrupt you just one more time and bring it up? Wow, you just looked at me like I can break you.
I will break you.
Okay, go ahead, Ivan.
If he dies, he dies. From Stephen Bell, for a defensive carbine, short-barreled rifle, or I guess AR pistol, what do you prefer between 300 Blackout or 5.56, and why?
Well, I prefer 300 Blackout if I'm getting it for free. What? We occasionally get ammo for free, I'm just saying. It's in all seriousness. When 300 Blackout comes down in price, that will probably be my go-to rifle round. I like it a lot because it's a very versatile round. The thing is, when we look at the availability of 5.56 and how important it is to train with the gun that we're going to depend on, I think 5.56 gets the nod just from the sheer training standpoint. The ability to run a subsonic 300 Blackout, though, and be very quiet, or step up to 110 grain supersonic TSX, it does really bad things. Especially if I'm going to be running short barrels, the short-barreled rifles tend to work a little bit better in 300 Black. As far as terminal effectiveness and longer upset ranges of the cartridge. But I think a lot of people worry about stuff like that, and it's not the thing that I would worry about so much, if that makes sense. So, Jack.
All righty. Do you think, I'm having trouble with his name here. Do you think, I'll read it out in a second. I want to get the question out. Do you think double action, single action is going to become favorable again, or has Striker Fired pretty much replaced it?
So what was that guy's name? Come on. Sound it out. Use your words.
I had it, and I lost it in my list. That's why.
I want to make fun of you again. So double action, single action. I think that... So if we're looking at the expenditure of resources necessary to get good with either system, I'm not going to say that it's as easy to get good with a double action, single action as it is to get good with a striker-fired gun. That having been said, it's not as hard to get good with one as people like to make it sound. And honestly, I think there are a lot of advantages to having that longer travel on the first trigger press. Now, I'm actually right now running a P30 LEM, which is their kind of advantage of the double action with some of the advantages of the one trigger press, you know, shorter actual sear engagement. But anyway, I think a lot of people overlook the value in having room to make a mistake and change your mind. And I think that the people that don't see value in that are, I don't know if sheltered's the right word, but are maybe not considering all aspects of the issue, if that makes sense. So, yeah. So what was that guy's name? That's okay. That's do you want me to find it?
I'm having trouble finding it again is the problem. I've got a lot of questions here.
Jack, I'm so sad and disappointed. It's Kyle Goley.
Okay.
So you're welcome, Kyle. I'm sorry that Jack hates you for some unknown reason, but he will be properly disciplined. I'm enjoying this show because I get to make fun of you a lot. And usually I'm too scared to do it, but I don't think you're going to murder your boss live on air. We don't know, but I mean, we'll see. Anyway.
From John Lauer, what is the applicability of a shoot house class for the typical non-mil or law enforcement officer?
Whether or not there is one is going to be very determined, very much determined by what level of shooter are you. I don't think there's any value if you are new to all of this to going and doing something like that. The reason why this comes up is that someone recently posted a photo from a instructor's shoot house class where you've got two stacks of dudes going through a door, and each dude that's going through the door is getting muzzled in the face by a guy with a Chris SMG and all that. Well, civilian legal. Anyway, the reason why I bring it up, and I'm not going to name any names, but I wouldn't take a shoot house class from the people that were running that if you paid me to, probably. And that's not to say they're not nice guys. It's just I look at something like that, and I'm like, wow, that's bad on multiple levels. And the problem becomes when people that have no foundation to speak of go and do stuff like that and think they're learning something, and they're not. Or if they are learning anything, they're not learning anything good. Now, once you're a advanced shooter or at least intermediate shooter, can you go and push yourself and learn about how you react under pressure that you are not likely to face on your own or even at a normal training class? Yeah, that's got a lot of value. Seeing how you process information under stress is of, you know, very, very great importance. That was a weird way to say what I just said, but you get the idea. But, you know, I'll give you, for instance, I really try and make it a habit to go to the Pat Rogers shoot house class every year, once a year. Am I going to be running partner tactics with carbines and plate carriers in my day-to-day life? I mean, maybe now that Jack's working for me, but usually probably not. But I get something out of it, and one of the things that I get out of it is putting myself in a situation that's extremely uncomfortable for me, that's got me thinking about a lot of things, and is forcing the shooting skills to be at the unconscious level while I process information and you know, process the room, deal with threats and all that. So am I getting, like, something of value if I need to clear my house? Well, no, I probably wouldn't clear my house. And if I do clear my house, I'm probably not going to be doing it as part of a team with plates. But, you know, there are little things that I can pick up that will help in all sorts of different situations. So, yeah, there is value for civilians, even if that's not their job at all. It's just whether or not that value or what that value is going to be determined by the student and where they're at, if that makes sense, and the information that they glean from it. So anyway, next question.
All righty. From Tyler Higgins, do you pursue any training outside of firearms and other self-defense tools?
I choose to take that, do I have any hobbies? That's how I choose to take that question. Do I have any hobbies? Well, if I worked a little less hard, I probably would, but right now I don't. I was a bass player for many years, which a lot of people don't really know. I used to be okay at it, but I'm not anymore. I would like to, and here, this is a hobby that would be more in line with what I do. I just don't have the time to do it right now. I'd like to go roll jits if I had time. That's one of the weaker aspects to my overall self-defense game, you know. I'd like to take up knitting, maybe. Weaving, basket weaving. That's what I I will learn how to do. So, yeah. Medical training would actually be something else. I have thought about going in and getting an EMT certification. I just, once again, finding the time. Yeah, because the free time that I do have, which there's very little of, but I don't like to do my job in my free time, which I know is shocking. But so anyway, we got about 30 seconds before the break. So if you have a question, you can ask it, and then I'll think about it during the break.
What is your opinion on having insurance for self-defense litigation expenses?
So Jeff Gonzalez and I were talking about this not too long ago, and yeah, I'll share my thoughts on that in probably about 7 seconds once I say the whole, you know, what you're listening to and all that, but I got to kill. Oh, wait, here we are. You're listening to Ballistic Radio! Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by TacStrike Steel Target Systems, makers of the quarter scale steel target and the arch frame target stand, which are literally the best steel targets and target stands I've ever used. Hit their steel targets with more than 60,000 rounds of rifle and pistol ammunition without a single problem. For more information, visit them at TacStrike.com. So we are answering your questions tonight. One before the break, if you want to just go over it again.
This is from Francisco Sanchez. What is your opinion on having insurance for self-defense litigation expenses?
I don't, you know, I've not seen anything compelling that shows me I want to have that. Jeff Gonzalez has some thoughts about it, and I don't know if he's posted that blog yet or not, but I'm going to be a total cop-out and just sort of avoid that one a little bit. We'll say this. I think that having a relationship with whichever attorney is going to represent you to make sure your life is not completely ruined, having a relationship before you get into the self-defense shooting is a really good idea. And my understanding of the way that works is they just sort of send who's available, depending on which one it is. And if I'm wrong, then I'm wrong, and I apologize, and I'd be the first one to admit this is not an area that I am knowledgeable enough on to have an opinion that's worthwhile. So we'll leave it at that.
Alrighty, from Lee Weems. This week I found myself in the unusual position where I could not have a firearm on me. A fixed blade knife would have been a viable option. Which fixed blade knife and how should I carry it? Would you recommend?
Trying to imagine the situation where he could have a knife but can't have a gun.
I was a little blown away also.
He's a chief deputy of a sheriff's department, so I'm like, huh? So if you're going to carry a fixed blade knife, I prefer it to be centerline. I prefer it to be relatively small so that you can access it with very little movement on your part. Because if someone's wrestling, you know, if you're in a an entangled situation, the longer the length of the blade, the more movement it requires before you've got that blade out of the sheath, the easier it is for someone to interrupt that. I'm a big fan of the clinch pick idea, and there's several different people doing versions of that. I am a huge fan of the special circumstance blades, which are a titanium and carbon fiber laminate. But they're expensive. You know, they're made by hand. They're great, great knives. But if you don't have the money for something like that, you can get a, you know, a China pick is what they're called. They're the version of the clinch pick that's made in China. They're relatively cheap. I want to say $75 or $80. You know, from Triple Ought Design is who's got them most of the time. And you can have something like that, get a trainer for it, too, if you're wanting to work with it and not cut yourself with a live blade. That would be my suggestion. But you want to be able to get to it with either hand. Center line works pretty well for me. You know, once again, be familiar with your local laws and all that. A lot of places where it's legal to carry a firearm, it might not be legal to carry a fixed blade knife. Just whether or not that makes sense, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, that was my disclaimer of please don't sue me.
From Derek Brenneman. You have convinced me to consider a shotgun from home defense.
I'm sorry.
I have young children. Do you have a recommendation for quick access securing methods?
I think the easiest way to do that would be if you've got the action open and you just run like a bicycle chain, you know, through the loading port and the ejection port, assuming that it's a gun that accepts that, and, you know, maybe have that around the post of your bed. You know, that's not a, Jack's like, I've never thought of that.
I hadn't.
That's, you know, that's not a way to keep the gun from being stolen if someone gets into your house, but it is a way to make sure that your kids don't get a gun. You need to secure it some way. The one thing that I will say that a lot of people get wrong is they will leave a round chambered in a shotgun and store it that way. Shotguns are very, very not drop safe. The safety does not block the hammer from falling. It blocks the trigger from moving. So there's, and now I'm like in my head going, I hope I said that the right way so I don't sound like an idiot. The other thing too is that it doesn't take much. I am aware of multiple instances where a shotgun was stored like muzzle up in a closet, fell over sideways, and then killed someone. So, but I think that's the most cost conscious way to store one relatively safely is, like I said, have the action broken open, run a bicycle cable lock or something through the loading port, out the ejection port, and then around like the post of your bed or something like that.
Alrighty. From Adam Smith, where can you get good information regarding improving trigger control?
That's one of those things where working with someone that kind of knows what they're doing, that can watch what you're doing and offer pointers is semi-important. You can watch videos. There's YouTube videos from some of the better known guys. I should have researched this one beforehand and I could tell you exactly who's got really good ones. Essentially the thing that there's a couple tips. If someone's telling you a specific part of your finger needs to be on a specific part of the trigger, I disagree with them. They don't know what they're talking about. And the reason why I say that, excuse me, it's not that they don't know what they're talking about. They're misinformed. The reason why I say that is all our hands are different sizes. So the amount of finger that I need to sink into the trigger guard to get an even press to the rear is different than the amount of finger that someone like Melody Lauer with, you know, little carny midget hands needs to get a smooth press to the rear versus someone like Jack-Jack, you know, who's got big meat hooks. The other thing, too, is the firearm determines that a lot as well. You know, if I'm shooting a J-frame where the trigger reach is significantly different than on, you know, an HK USP 45 tactical double action, there's not a hard and fast rule there. Pat McNamara's got good videos about that. I was just thinking. Go check out his stuff. He talks about that a little bit. You know, generally what I end up doing is I will try and get onto the distal joint of my trigger finger, which for those that don't know is the joint furthest away from your knuckle. Thank you, Jack-Jack. But that's generally where I have the most success with a lot of different types of firearms. But like I said, you know, you see those charts online where they like show finger position versus deviation on the target. I'm like, no, not quite. So anyway.
Alrighty, from Nick Helig, and this should eat up what we got. For budget-minded folks, do you have a recommendation on literature or drills for the range? Obviously, this doesn't replace professional training, but at least it adds something to basic skills.
Your estimation of what's going to eat up the rest of the show and my estimation of what's going to eat up the rest of the show are two different things, Jack, I just have to say. I'll make this really easy. Go to pistoltraining.com and click on the drills tab, or go to pistolforum.com, and there's a hyphen in between pistol and forum or pistol and training, and they have entire sections dedicated to stuff like that. And even discussions on what you're working on there. So, uno más.
All righty. Would you suggest a form of martial arts to complement weapons training?
Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu seems to be very effective with how a lot of fights in real life turn out if there's only one or two attackers. And it's pretty simplistic, and it works pretty well under actual pressure and testing, you know. Or if you really wanted to be complete about it, I think that if you went to a quality MMA gym and learned a little bit of a stand-up game and a little bit of a ground game, you would be massive steps ahead of almost everybody else. So we got about 60 seconds left. Jack's going to say alrighty one more time and then maybe get a quick question in. You were about to.
Alrighty. Do you have a recommendation to create a more rolling break on out of a Glock trigger?
I have had a lot of success with the SSVI tier trigger. To full disclosure, I have a business relationship with SSVI at this point. I will say this. I bought with my own money, with full retail, five or six of these before we ever had any sort of deal. I really do feel it's the best aftermarket Glock trigger currently available. I've had a lot of success dropping one of those in with a minus connector and getting a trigger pull that I find to be really, really nice, you know, and is what I want out of a Glock trigger. Now, to be completely honest, I don't like two-stage glass rod break Glock triggers. I know a lot of other people do. That's just not really what I'm into. But anyway, we should be coming up on the end of the show right about meow. Hey, look at that. So next week it's going to be a recorded show because we are going to SHOT Show. Oh, and I haven't announced who we're going to SHOT Show with yet. We are actually road tripping out there with Steve Fisher, Tatiana Whitlock, Adam Roth of Aridus Industries, and Melody Lauer, as well as Jack and myself. We are going to be doing some video content from the big giant van that we've rented to drive out there. The tactical short bus will be rolling. Anyway, you can check out stuff like that on our Facebook page. Make sure you give that a like. Also, check out the website, ballisticradio.com, for past shows. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe, and see you next week.